Good morning, everyone, and I thank you for being here. I was going to say to be inside on such a beautiful day, but it's air-conditioned here, so I think I know why everybody else is here. So first of all, thanks, Ted, for inviting me, and Bill, for making sure the computer works. It does seem to so far. We will see. I often talk in the afternoon, and I warn people it's nap time, and I might fall asleep, but it's okay. It's this morning. But I want to ask a question. When you're sleeping and you dream, and when you're dreaming, do you ever dream that you're flying? Do you fly in your dreams? Some people do, and other people don't. And every paraglider pilot I've ever known has always dreamt that they were flying. And that was true for me, even as a tiny baby, small kid. I just would fly in my dreams. I would get off the ground, fly around the room, go out the window, fly across town. Originally like Superman, because I was watching Superman on TV or reading the comic books. Of course, Peter Pan is another example, lots of people flying. And I don't know if you know about this, when Peter Pan first appeared as a play in the theater in London. And the story was, if you believed you could fly, you could fly. And then it became a book, and people were reading it to their kids' bedtime. And the kids were attempting to fly, which had not good results. So he changed the story, and it required fairy dust from Tinkerbell before you could fly. And that was for safety for children. That was added in 1912. But people have been dreaming of flying since time immemorial, just kind of like this. We were in Dubai a couple of years ago, and we took a little boat across the LSAF on the other side of the creek, and we found this store that sells magic rugs. So if you go in there, they'll give you a cup of tea while you discuss the price of whatever rug you would like to buy. And we all know the story of Daedalus and Icarus. And if you've read Ovid in his Metamorphoses, and I was reading that a couple of years ago, and I was totally amazed. His descriptions of looking down on the Greek islands was so accurate. Having flown around in these places, it was hard to believe that he could describe what it looks like from the air without having ever flown himself. Da Vinci, of course, had lots of flying machines, and you'll read this quote from Leonardo da Vinci all of the time. There's only one problem with this quote. It's not Leonardo da Vinci's at all. It was actually written by an American documentary creator who decided to write that in the script and attribute it to da Vinci, and it's been attributed to him ever since. So I got really excited by paragliding about 1999, and as time went on, I wanted to go to more places to fly. And I bought this little camper. It's called a Romahome. It's a tiny Citroën Seicans. If you've been in France, every farmer's got one of these, or at least they used to 30, 40 years ago. And it gets 50 miles to the gallon. It's great for cheap traveling. You can sleep in the back. And I would sleep in paragliding sites and fly down and have my cup of tea when I arrived. And I went for a little drive. Basically, I would spend a few months every year. I did about 80,000 kilometers around Europe. And then the engine died, and I moved to South America and bought another camper and drove all around South America. But when I came to Canada, and I would say I'd done a lot of paragliding, and then a week later, the people would ask me, and this was at my local St. Catharines Provost Club, tell me more about that parasailing. And I realized people around here don't know what paragliding is. In other parts of the world, it's very popular, everybody knows. But here, people think it's parasailing, and so I created a little talk on paragliding is not parasailing, and not a lot of other things as well. So I want to tell you a little bit about different ways that you can get high, just so that you can keep track of all of the various ways of flying. So if you've seen this, every time you go to the Caribbean or Muskoka, you get towed behind a boat. There's a rope. You have no control. The boat driver controls everything. You go follow him around. Go up if he goes faster. Go down if he goes slower. And that, of course, is parasailing. And I'm sure everybody knows what that is. And some people think that I'm doing this when I talk about paragliding. It's a triangular wing. It's got a metal frame. And you can fold it up and put it on the roof of your car, but you can't put it in a backpack and take it on a plane trip with you. And that's hang gliding, which in a lot of the world is called Delta. And it's been around since 1891, the very first hang glider flight, but it became more important in the 1960s when NASA was looking for ways to float their spaceships back to Earth, and Francis Regalo invented the wing, which is what is still being used today. Anybody have an idea what we're looking at here? Nobody's seen this? This was the parachute jump at Coney Island from 1939 to 1960. They would take people up 250 feet in a crane and drop them on these great big parachutes, which were guided by wires. You can see the wires down the side here, so it would bring you down. The tower is still there, but they don't do the parachute jumps anymore. But there's another way to fly, and you might have seen this one before. This is Lawn Chair Larry. Larry Walters lived in San Pedro, California, and he went out and bought 45 weather balloons and a tank of helium, and he filled up the weather balloons and tied it to a lawn chair. The lawn chair was tied to the ground, and when it started to leave the ground, he cut the rope, and off he went. He got to 16,000 feet over Long Beach Airport, where he was reported to air traffic control by the planes that were coming in to land. And if you know where Long Beach Airport is, it's on the Pacific coast, and he realized if he didn't come down soon, he was going to be in the middle of the ocean. But he was prepared. He took out his BB gun and began shooting balloons. And, you know, you shoot a few balloons and you don't go up anymore, you start to go down. So Lawn Chair Larry came down. Fortunately, unfortunately and fortunately, he landed in some power lines, which luckily he did not get killed by, because most people who in that situation don't survive. But he actually got the balloons caught, was able to get off on the ground where the sheriffs apprehended him. He was charged with flying, violating controlled airspace, flying without a balloon license, and operating a non-worthy aircraft, for which he was fined $4,000, which was reduced to $1,500 on appeal. He also won, this is real, he won the top prize in the Bonehead Club. I did not know there was such a thing, but he won, and of course a Darwin Award for helping to improve the gene pool. We've all talked about flying cars, but I don't think it's going to be this kind of flying car. Flying cars are going to be pretty real, though. There are several companies getting very close. So back in 1988, some guys in Queenston, New Zealand, decided that they would jump off a bridge with a big elastic band. And I read about this in Time magazine in December. And since by chance I was going to New Zealand in January, I went and was one of the first people to jump off a bridge with a bungee jump and have a t-shirt to prove it. Now, other people, when I talk about paragliding, they're picturing something like this, guys falling out of planes and opening some kind of a parachute. And that's really skydiving. You start with a plane, you have free fall for 10, 30 seconds, you open your parachute, now you have control of it, unlike the old ones back in World War II, and you can choose where you're going to land. This is the oldest person to do a tandem parachute jump, Dorothy Hoffner. It's a couple of years ago. She was almost 105, and it was on her bucket list, and she needed to finish her bucket list, so she went over 2023, according to my notes here. And she enjoyed her skydive and actually died in her sleep a couple of weeks later. So I guess once you've done everything you want to do. But it's really important to wear the right kinds of clothes if you're going to go skydiving, because these people wore the wrong clothes and it was a decision that affected them for their entire lives. Perhaps it's important what you say as well, but yes, they got married in free fall. The first guy to jump out of a balloon was Henri-Jacques Garnerin in Paris, 1797, jumped from 2,000 feet, and he got airsick because it was a windy day and he got tossed around a bit, but he did land safely in Parc-Monceau in Paris. Now, some people think I'm doing this when I talk about paragliding, and that's jumping off a building or jumping off a cliff and then opening your parachute just before you hit the ground. Base jumping is really the most dangerous sport you can do. We measure sports dangers and other dangers by what's your percentage chance of death if you do it for 1,000 hours. And in this case, it's 99%. So, very dangerous sport. You might have seen this. It's called a wingsuit. And the first wingsuit person was a tailor, also in Paris, Franz Reichelt. And he jumped off the Eiffel Tower in 1912. But sadly, his wingsuit didn't work. In 1930, a 19-year-old American did it in Los Angeles and was successful. And then in the 1990s, with modern materials, they made better gliding wingsuits, and a lot of people do it. You can take somebody with you if you know somebody who would like to go for a ride on your wingsuit. These guys were paid by Red Bull to fly through Tower Bridge in London. So they went at 250 kilometers an hour, and they were dropped from a helicopter, and they went right under the bridge. Now, then there's Yves Rossy, another Frenchman. He decided that it would be a good idea to take four little jet engines and attach them to a fiberglass wing, and then he could go flying around quite quickly, 250 kilometers an hour. Emirates hired him to do a commercial where he flew alongside an Airbus A380 for a commercial for them. This is not a paraglider, it's actually a kite. And if you're flying a big kite, remember to let go. And you've probably seen lots of this, very popular these days, on beaches or on the water. And it's kite surfing, very similar to paragliding. The only problem is that if you get in the air, you don't have control of where you go, so it can become quite dangerous and quite scary if the winds get strong, too strong for you. But if you want to just gently float around the air, maximum speed about 20 kilometers an hour, then the sport of paragliding is for you. That's me down there in a wing I had for quite a long time, and just an enjoyable sport. The launch is very easy. We often start on a grassy slope like this, and you bring the wing up, and you literally walk forwards, and the ground drops out from below you, and you go straight ahead because of the wing that's holding you up. And it can be very gentle in the right circumstances. And it's always in beautiful places. So all around the world, you go to places on mountains or on seashores, and it's beautiful. And there's hundreds and hundreds of places to fly in the world, just very few of them around this part of Canada. It's so popular in Switzerland, it's on the 50-franc note. They have a picture of a paraglider. And they already did a commercial where they took a car up in a paraglider. 2012. This is a picture I took when I flew to the Matterhorn. I launched in Zermatt. It took me a couple of hours to get to the top of the Matterhorn. And you could see the mountain climbers who were climbing up. It takes them 2-3 days. And it's actually very dangerous. A lot of people die trying to go up the Matterhorn because it's one of those goals. A picture I took in Colombia flying. And it's just always something beautiful. This is in Hawaii near the Haleakala volcano. I ran into this sign sometime where apparently paragliding is a lot like sex. The first time you try it, you're nervous, but it's still the best thing you've ever tried. And as you can see, if you enjoy sex, you'll love paragliding. But we have competitions in paragliding. This is a picture that I took one day when we were at a competition. I've not been a competitor myself. I really didn't want to do that, but I've helped with the organization of competitions. And then some of the experienced pilots launch before the competitors, because otherwise you can't see what's in the air. And we will fly to see if there's high winds somewhere, maybe there's some rising air to go looking for. And the name for us is a wind dummy, who tests the air for a competition. So this is the kind of thing we would have with us. You'd have your phone, you'd have a radio, and you have an instrument called a variometer. And a variometer tells you whether you're going up or down. When you're in the middle of the air, you don't have anything to relate to, and your ear can't tell you if you're going up or going down when it's just a small amount. So we have a device that actually shows us on an LCD screen, but more importantly, without looking at it, it will beep. If you're going up, it goes beep, 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 beep. And if you're going down, it goes blah, blah, blah. And the idea is to keep it beeping, to go up. So to start with, you've got this wing that looks a lot like a parachute, and you spread it out in front of you with the wind coming from behind. And as you pull on these lines, which maybe not hard to see, but they're down here, you pull the lines and the wind will actually spread that wing right out. And you do what we call building a wall. And that gives you the opportunity to take a look at it, make sure there's nothing damaged from the previous flight or from packing it up, make sure there's no tangles in the lines, that all this is straight, make sure it's connected to your harness. And then you turn around, and it comes up behind you as you slowly walk forward, and you bring it up into the air. Depending on how strong the wind is, sometimes you might have to run. Depending on the slope, it's slightly different, but that's the general idea. The dangerous time is just at the beginning, when you lift it off the ground. If the wind comes up, it can drag you backwards, and that's when most accidents occur when you're paragliding. As you bring it up higher, there's less strength on it, and when you get higher, it starts to take you off the ground, depending on the wind. So here's a picture just after launch. I'm in San Andres Les Alpes, and I've gotten up above the ground. And what we do when we get in the air is we look for thermals, the same as the birds. I'm sure you've seen birds circling around, getting higher up in the air. And you get into a thermal, and then you try to stay in that little column of rising air, and you go round and round, following it up towards the clouds. I've launched. You can see the next guy's about to launch down here. And I used to be able to read that variometer, but I think I'm a few thousand feet above him. And I found a nice thermal, so he's just now ready to launch, and I'm even higher as I get higher and higher up. There are lots of pictures of my feet in my collection of pictures. So to get cross-country, you use the thermals, and so what you do is get into the first thermal, go up. When you get close to the clouds and you stop rising, you look for where there might be another one, and then you fly as fast as you can, because this air is going down, and it will take you back to the ground very quickly, and hopefully find another thermal which will take you up, and you continue to do this as many times as you can to get distance if you want to go further away. So people ask, how far can you fly? Well, for me, the longest is 166 kilometers, and that was from Slovenia into Italy. But the record is 610 kilometers in Texas. Somebody flew for 11 hours and set a record in 2021, which is still standing for a straight flight. This just compares the glide ratio from we can go 9 meters forward for every meter we go down. Hang gliders more like 16, sailplanes are more like 50 to 1, so they can go forward 50 kilometers and only go down 1,000 meters. And what we look for are those little white puffy clouds. Generally when there's rising air, it reaches the dew point and it forms these little white puffy clouds. And when I'm at the lake and I'm looking out and I see those puffy clouds, I think, what a perfect day for flying, I wish I was out there. And if you get a line of them, we call this a cloud street. So this gives us the opportunity to go up to one, down, up to the next one, up to the next one, and that's how I flew across Slovenia and Italy. There's a lot of rising air over plowed fields, so that's always a good place. Be careful if you fly over even small ponds and lakes, because they're colder and you're likely to descend quickly. And one of the tricks I found was if you see a dead tree on the hillside, there's almost always a thermal there. And I don't know whether the tree is dead because the thermal brought the insects, or there's some other reason why it seems to point out where is a place for thermals. But of course, looking at the birds and watching what they do, because they're really smart and know how to find the thermals. So you see these birds circling. Turkey vultures are actually one of the best flyers. You watch them easily around here, and you can see how amazing they are at staying up. So I was in California, and I saw these birds, vultures, circling, and I thought, there's a thermal over there. I'm going to head that direction and pick up that thermal and join those birds. It turns out vultures also circle around dead cows. And one of the things when you're flying is you can actually smell everything and hear everything that's on the ground. And usually it's pleasant, but not if it's a dead cow. He went flying over the Swiss Alps, I'm about 3,000 meters high, and it's a place called Fisch, and you get to fly over a glacier. You could see a little observation point down here that people have come up on a cable car. I knew I was high when I was flying there because a plane flew below me as I was flying around. But one of the gorgeous sights you can't see in any other way. You can go up to that observation deck, but there's no place where you can see this glacier unless you're up there. So how high can you fly? And legally, it's just under 18,000 feet. Above 18,000 feet is controlled airspace. Jets fly around and they can't see you, so they're likely to run into you. But we'd like to fly as high as we can. My highest flight was in Italy, and it was in the Dolomites. Anybody know this particular mountain? It's got a very easy to remember name. It's Locomotiva, because it just looks like a locomotive. And this is where I flew to 17,999 feet, because it would have been illegal if I'd flown any higher than that. And you have to watch out for airspace. The interesting thing is I wasn't planning to fly high that day. I was in shorts and a t-shirt and got a good thermal and it kept going up. And if you go up, you're supposed to have oxygen about 10,000 feet. But I didn't. But you're always trying to get higher and higher, so you keep going up. And then hypoxia starts to set in. And one of the results of hypoxia is your decision-making is not so great. So I kept going higher. And when I got to around 18,000 feet, the view was great. I could see Switzerland in one direction. I could see down to the Adriatic in the other direction. And I thought I'm going to take some pictures. But my camera wouldn't work because it was too cold. And that helped me decide that it was time to go back down. But you have to be aware of airspace. When you're flying, if you're near airports, you need to know exactly where airplanes might be flying. And I used to fly quite close to San Jose Airport when we lived in California. So we had to be aware of all of the different traffic around there. There's actually on the charts the pilots have is a hang glider or a sailplane, because that was an area for sailplanes as well. But then there was Eva Wisniewska. And she was training for a competition in Australia for a World Cup. And there were two big thunderstorms. And she thought, I can fly between these clouds. Unfortunately, they grabbed her and took her up into the clouds. She got sucked up to over 32,000 feet. Lost consciousness when she was at 18,000 feet. She was completely covered in ice. Another pilot in the same storm didn't survive. But when she came back down around 10,000 feet, she regained consciousness and literally had to chip her way out of the ice that had formed around her and did manage to land safely. Now, the other question people say is, do we fly with the birds? Well, most birds ignore us, but if they're protecting their nest, eagles in particular can come out and attack, and they will start pecking at your wing. But then there's Scott Mason, and he has rescued birds that have been in accidents and rehabilitated them and trained them to help find thermals for him, and he rewards them with food. So he flies with these Egyptian vultures in Nepal. And you can go on a tandem flight, and he will bring the birds to you. So one time I was flying in California, and there was this hawk. And I'm going this way, and the hawk is coming directly towards me. And most of the time, the birds will see you, and they'll sort of go somewhere else. But this hawk was watching a rabbit, and the rabbit was on the ground, and he was looking down, paying absolutely no attention to where he was going. And I was starting to get ready for what happens when he runs into me. And literally about the distance of you there, he saw me and went squawk and straight down, dropped underneath me, which was very good, because the tangled hawk would not have been good. Now, the other thing that is surprising is people take their dogs. And I don't know, maybe I've seen a dozen people fly with their dogs. The dogs love it. You see the pilot spreads the wing out. The dog comes running, wagging its tail, knowing it's going to go for a flight. They actually really enjoy it. I have never seen anyone fly with a cat. This guy's actually flying with a dog and his son. And in France, they're helping out with paraplegics and launching people with wheelchairs. And they even have a competition for people flying with wheelchairs. This story was in the paper last year. A woman who had always wanted to do paragliding, her husband wouldn't allow it. When her husband passed away, she took it up and was really excited. And they wrote about it in the paper. And of course, the record for paragliding, so there's still a chance for everybody in this room, 105-year-old woman. I had a moral dilemma one day. I'm flying in California, and I look down, and on the top of this little hill in front of me, I see a mother and a little baby deer, and think, oh, this is wonderful. The kind of thing you only see when you get the opportunity to be up here, and just enjoying the sight. And as I flew over the edge of the hill, I'm watching a mountain lion who also knows about these deer on the top of the hill. So do I warn the deer so that they can run? But the mountain lion's not going to have his lunch. And as it happens, I started to have to fly somewhere else to get the thermals, so I never did find out what happened. Different ways to stay up. I've already told you about thermal. The other is ridge lift. When the wind comes in and it hits any kind of a ridge, it goes up, and you can fly back and forth along this ridge. And then the third kind is called wave, and it's actually because the wind goes over the ridge, and back here, it's like a sine wave, and it will take you up, and it can get you very high. A lot of flying on the coast, it's very consistent, good place for learning, because the wind comes in the afternoon, and it's the same speed, and it's easy to fly, good for doing acrobatics and things as well. How does a paraglider work? So, whoops. Up at the top, the canopy is open, and the air comes in through these little holes and fills it up, so it inflates with the air as you go forwards. And then you've got the lines that attach to the harness. And then what's called brake lines, which aren't really brakes, but they deform the shape of the canvas in such a way that you can turn left and turn right, and that's your directional control. Some newer ones have got fewer lines, but the ones I was flying would have four lines, which we called A, B, C, and D. And you can see the harness is very much like a little seat that we sit in, and this is where you would attach the lines going up to the canopy that holds you up. So you're sitting, you don't have to hold on to anything other than the brakes for being held up. This is just a picture of my hands on the brake handles. So this is how I steer. If I want to go right, I pull down, let the one on the left go up. And also there's some weight shift involved, which helps me to turn. So it becomes more of exercise than it looks, because you're always shifting your weight around to maintain stability. A picture somebody took of me, that's me at sunset in Bucaramanga, Colombia. And at the time, I had a solar-powered variable, and I couldn't figure out why it wasn't beeping. And then I realized the sun was going down, and I wasn't getting enough sun anymore. So all those lines can get tangled up, especially if you pack up really quickly. And a friend might help you to launch, but your best friend is somebody who helps you to untangle all those lines when they get tangled up. And somebody here has got their best friend helping them. So the only plane that you can actually carry in a backpack is a paraglider. This is probably, it's either a very old one or it's a tandem big enough for two people. That's more like an ordinary size. And quite often we will hike up maybe 1,000 meters to find a nice place to launch from and fly from there. This is me with a group of people hiking up at Chamonix to find a nice spot to launch. Normally, you would have taken the cable car, but it was out closed for repairs, so we had to hike. In Switzerland, there are a lot of cable cars for the ski resorts, and they're in the summertime for hikers and also for paraglider pilots, so it's an absolute dream. You just take the cable car to the top, go flying, and you get back to the bottom, take it up again, go for another flight. A lot less strenuous than hiking. In Saint-Hilaire de Touvet in France, there's a funicular railway that takes you up, which is kind of cool. But the most common way is probably in some kind of a jeep, 4x4. The roads are incredibly rough. There's one in Potato Hill in California, which we call the Widowmaker. And the only injury I ever had in my paragliding career was actually in the back of a truck going up the road on the way. when it went over a big bump and I tore my rotor cuff. But when you get to the top, sometimes the winds are not blowing the right direction or the right speed, and there's another sport we call para-waiting. And this is waiting to see for the weather to change to be exactly right. And this is where one of the reasons my wife Jane doesn't want to do this sport at all is she doesn't have that patience. She can't understand I would drive 4 hours from home, go to the top of a mountain, sit there for 4 hours, find out the weather never did change, climb back down again, drive 4 hours home, and never having flown. But that's part of the sport as well. And of course, parachuting sometimes lasts a long time. Sometimes it's cold. You might need to spread your wing around you to stay warm. This is actually very close to here. I'm not sure if he still does it. I don't think so. But about a half an hour south of here, where people were towed into the air. Instead of jumping off a cliff or jumping off a mountain, you're towed by a winch, which is a motorcycle motor, pulls a 1 kilometer line, and as it pulls you into the air, then when you get up high, you release it. So is it dangerous? Well, this one looks dangerous. But just to compare, and I said before, the chance of dying in 1,000 hours of doing it. So flying in a commercial plane, 0.01%, very safe, safer than driving a car. And you can compare it, 4 times more dangerous to be driving. Resort skiing is a bit more, cycling, lots of other dangerous activities that you could be involved in. Sailplanes, of course, there's paragliding, parachuting humor. If you can't read it, the guy says, oh no, what is it? The parachute won't open. Don't worry, you got the rest of your life to figure it out. Sure, rock climbing is dangerous, but I think it's because you could get distracted. And as I said, base jumping, 99% probability. So paragliding in 1,000 hours is 2.9%. It's very much the same as downhill mountain biking. Skydiving is actually more dangerous. Hang gliding is just slightly less dangerous. And that's actually, if you look at the danger versus survivability at different ages, paragliding is about the same as being 95 years old. Some of the other sports, like rock climbing, is about the same as being 110. So the most danger is just as you're launching, where the wind might grab your wing and pull you back, especially if there are any rocks or something to be pulled into. Equipment failure almost never happens, but did happen once here. This looks bad, but actually, if you're not flying a competition or a sport wing, but just a wing designed for your average weekend flyer, the wing will recover by itself. Literally, the best thing to do is nothing. If you try to do something, you're likely to make it worse, and the wing will just go back into a flying position, which is very reassuring. Sometimes, of course, things get tangled up, where you get something like this, in which case you need to throw a reserve parachute, and we carry a reserve parachute, which will help us out if the wing stops flying. And it's got a nice big red handle. When you're in trouble and you think it's the last chance to do something, you pull out this reserve parachute, and it brings you not quite softly down to the ground. It's designed that you might break something, but you're not going to die. So here's an example. We should have sound. If you didn't see what happened there, a plane. This happened in May, just less than 2 months ago. This person was hit by a plane while she was flying in Austria. Has thrown her reserve parachute, and she's on her way down to the ground. Do we have sound, Bill? There should be sound on this. Yes, pretty much. There you go. Oops, we missed it, but you'll see. She aimed for a tree, which is what you're supposed to do. If you're coming down too fast like that, you go for the outer branches of a tree.
Oh!
totally survived, only a few bruises. The pilot was charged with negligence.
Does he need you? Is he going to help?
This is the slow motion of the plane hitting the top of her paraglider. This is not something you want to have happen. But she's still flying. Another safety equipment we carry. Anybody know what safety equipment? Important to say, I used to have it always in the pocket of my harness. Nobody recognized it. Dental floss, exactly. Why would I carry dental floss when I go flying? Because if I land in a tree, I can lower the dental floss down. It's very strong, and somebody can tie a rope to it. And then I can bring the rope up and put it over the branch, and that would help me to get down out of the tree. And when people fly around trees, it happens. So Coup de Car is a big festival in France every year. I used to go when I was flying all the time. I would go most years. And I stopped flying about 10 years ago. But 2 years or 3 years ago was the 50th anniversary. And I thought, I'm going to go. I rented a camper and went to the Coup de Car. You get people doing aerobatics where they do things with their paraglider that most people don't do. And mainly you get a lot of people dressing up in costumes to just show off different ways of flying. It's a lot of fun. This is the guy that was in that tree, by the way. It turns out that having a dragon on your parachute and your paraglider slows you down. You don't make it to the landing field. September, lots of fun. One of the things you get to do there as well, they launch balloons in the early morning. And this is a picture I took of flying around the balloons as they're going up and I'm coming down into the landing field. And it got used in a calendar one place. Trouble with balloons is you don't always have control over where the balloon is going to go. And this balloon launched and went sideways. And this is a perfect example of the domino effect. And I think there were probably a few surprised people there. Just imagine. So the world's toughest race is run by Red Bull. It's called the X Alps. And it's amazing. You hike and fly from, in this case, Austria, up here down to Monaco. The newer ones recently, it's every other year, have flown around Switzerland and then back to Austria. But it's entirely hiking and flying, about 1,200 kilometers. You hike up the mountains, you fly as far as you can. When you land, you go back up the mountain, try again. And you have to stop at various places along the way and sign the board. It's just a fantastic race. These are the guys hiking up to start and all launching together. What's amazing is one person has won this for 6 times in a row. He's just an amazing pilot. And when you're done, after about a dozen days of hiking and flying, you end up landing in a raft in the middle of a lake now, in the middle of the sea in Monaco. If you look for YouTube videos, if you want to see people paragliding, there are lots and lots of them, including this guy. Ola Deniz is a great place in Turkey to fly. And he set himself up with a couch so he can relax while he flies. So one of the things you're supposed to do anytime you're flying, and this is true for sailplanes and even, I'm sure, private pilots here, is you should know where you might land in an emergency, so you keep an eye out for it. So you look for places that, okay, if I have to, I'll land. So this is, in Bucaramanga, I was staying in this hotel right here, and it was maybe 10 kilometers from where we were flying. But we had permission that if we could, we could land on the golf course and fly right back to the hotel. It was my last day, and I thought, I got up high. I think I can make it. And I was heading towards the golf course, and then I got into some sinking air. And as the problem is, this is a major highway, and if you're just slightly short, instead of landing in the golf course, you land on a four-lane highway. Not a good idea. But I had seen this lovely patch of green grass down below with some horses, and I thought, okay, I'll land there, and I can just get back to the hotel from here. It seemed like a really good idea. But what I didn't know, this was back in Colombia 20 years ago when FARC was very active, and the police were being attacked by guerrillas who were setting off bombs and doing various things. And where I had chosen to land was a police recreational area. And it was a gated community, fenced off. And the first thing that happened was some young kids came up and said, oh, where'd you come from? Come to the pool for a swim. And the second thing that happens was a bunch of guys with machine guns came up and said, what are you doing here? And do you have any bombs on you? After a few hours of discussion in Spanish, they called me a taxi, but it was a bit touch and go. In French, it's called parapente. And of course, being French, they have parapente house as well. Lots of pictures of people paragliding. So I put a camera on my helmet, which lets me take pictures and videos when I fly. So to finish this off, I'm going to take you on a little bit of a flight, and you can see what it feels like to be up in the air. So as you see, I've got my wing laid out in front of me. This the longer version of this is on YouTube. It's called Misty Mission. Mission is the name of the hill near Silicon Valley where I flew. I check my lines. I turn around and start walking forwards. And soon I'm up in the air. And this is nice because you can see a shadow of me on the side here. So I'm going to fly along the ridge. There's a little bit of a breeze coming in from the left from this side. And I'm going to fly back along that ridge, and it's going to keep me up. When I get to the end of the lift, I'll turn around and fly back again. So what's it feel like to land? You see a windsock. You want to land directly into the wind. That gives you the slowest speed over the ground, makes it easy to step down onto the ground. On a day like this, you literally just step down and maybe take a step forward, and you're on the ground. Very comfortable, very nice feeling. This is following a golden eagle in the Diablo Mountains in California. And so I followed that eagle, seeing what it find a thermal, and now I found one. This is what it feels like going around and around in a thermal. And you might do this for 20 minutes or so, and yes, some people do get dizzy. Even paraglider pilots have been known to get airsick going round and round and getting dizzy. Scott Mason with his Egyptian vultures. So this is a video I found on YouTube, and I think it's the most realistic feeling. It really does feel like what it feels like to be flying. I'm not sure how they made this, but it's very real feeling. Sometimes the air will pop up, and you'll end up flying up a little bit like that. Most of the time, you're just comfortably gliding along. You see him raising and lowering his hands as he controls the glider, making it fly straight if it wants to turn, or intentionally turning around in a thermal. Person in the background there is doing a bit of acro. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and hope you've enjoyed the flight. And probably have time for some questions if anybody has any questions.